Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 8th of March with me, Ian Welsh. As usual, coming up is the news review and information on what's coming up for us at Innovation Forum. And we've got InterIKEA's Eleonora Thierry, Circular Supply Chain Project Leader, on why the Swedish brand is committed to developing circular economy models. And there's another chance to listen to Lola Baroness-Young on how to move from talk to action on modern slavery. Next, though, is our regular news digest. A new report from the Ethical Trading Initiative with King's College London and the University of Warwick says that little progress is being made to develop substantive improvements in working conditions for production line workers. Titled Business Models and Labour Standards, Making the Connection, the report picks up two key weaknesses in current models. First, it criticises business initiatives for typically being little more than a sticking plaster, with companies concerned more about their reputation than really improving the conditions of workers. Second, and perhaps more interesting, is the assertion that while business initiatives may be well-meaning, they treat the symptoms of problems rather than the underlying causes, which are, the reports often say, driven by the very nature of business models, particularly in the food and apparel sectors. The report argues that the price competitiveness that characterises these sectors has increased pressure on competition and led to the development of retailers with little to no directly owned production capacity. The fast fashion model of cheap goods with short product life, with profits coming from volume, is particularly to blame. And a lack of seasonality in agriculture and emergence of no-frills discounters has driven the food sector to engage in aggressive price competition too. ETI and its partners propose an alternative approach, including redefining how and why value is created, along with more experimentation with different business models. More specific suggestions include how to integrate commercial and ethical strategies, developing better supply chain partnerships, and improving industrial relations. Global conservation NGO WWF has been in the firing line this week following a story from online news service BuzzFeed that alleges anti-poaching guards are engaged in violent assaults against local people, resulting in torture and even death. Specifically, BuzzFeed says that indigenous people living in and around national parks in Asia and Africa are shot, beaten, and sexually assaulted. WWF does fund and equip anti-poaching guards and has announced an immediate review into the allegations by an international law firm and reaffirming that human rights is at the core of its mission. Better news from West Africa's cocoa sector with the announcement from the World Cocoa Foundation that plans detailing how to end deforestation and restore forest areas in Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire have been agreed by the leading chocolate and cocoa companies and the two national governments. This process is part of the implementation commitments of the landmark Cocoa and Forest Initiative launched in 2017. The World Cocoa Foundation says that the Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire governments and the sector companies have committed to no further conversion of any forest land for cocoa production and to eliminate illegal production in protected areas. Companies will release their own individual plans over the coming weeks. But the announcement suggests that a milestone has been reached with apparent strength and transparency and accountability in the cocoa supply chain. The Cocoa and Forest Initiative is linked, of course, to countering climate change, and other news this week indicates how extreme climatic events are impacting many agri-sectors. In Italy, freak events of the sort predicted by scientists to occur as the climate changes have been blamed for a 57% drop in the national olive harvest, which has been the worst in 25 years. Erratic rainfall, early frosts, summer droughts, and strong winds have weakened the olive trees and made them more susceptible to disease. The Guardian reports that the cost of the current olive oil collapse is more than 1 billion euros already. And other reports say that Italy will be reliant on imported olives from April. The European Commission has said that the Portuguese and Greek olive crops have also been significantly impacted by recent weather events. Elsewhere, a new paper in the journal Science has highlighted the impact of warming oceans on fish populations, a key source of food and income for many millions of people. The amount of harvestable seafood fell 4.1% from 1930 to 2010, equivalent to 1.4 million tonnes less availability. The findings separate the impact of climate and warming waters from other impacts on the sector, such as overfishing. Some areas are impacted harder than others. The Northeast Atlantic and the Sea of Japan saw fish population declines of as much as 35% over the period of the study. Finally, and on a more positive note, is the innovation from US home cleaning product manufacturer SC Johnson developing the world's first plastic bottle made entirely from recycled ocean plastic for its Windex brand. 8 million units will be available in North American retailers. SC Johnson has committed to developing products that address waste problems and to create closed-loop solutions for plastics. And the 100% ocean plastic bottle demonstrates, if nothing else, that there is value in what we have all become far too used to simply throwing away. It's under a month until Innovation Forum's spring conference season gets underway, with the latest in our series examining what business must do to deal with modern slavery, in London on the 2nd and 3rd of April. If you'd like to join the likes of Mondelez, Pirelli, Walmart, Nestle, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, Schneider Electric and many more, then this week is your last chance to save £100 in conference passes. Secure your place by close of business on Friday 8th of March to get the discount, and I hope to see you there. Look out for the next in Innovation Forum's winter webinar series coming up next week on Thursday 14th of March, when we will be joined by experts from Mondelez, Barilo and Impossible Foods to discuss innovation in the food sector. Full details and links to sign up for free online are on the Innovation Forum website and in this week's newsletter. Interview time now. Last week I spoke with Eleonora Thierry, Circular Supply Chain Project Leader at Inter-IKEA Group, about how IKEA is developing new circular economy models and its new business furniture leasing pilot project in Sweden. We were on a slightly dodgy line, so my apologies that the sound quality is not as high as usual.
Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about the background to IKEA's new circular economy innovation.
For us, the change towards a circular business is the biggest change, but also opportunity for the future. We set a very ambitious goal. We said that we want to become a circular business by 2030. And as you can imagine, this change will impact all our organization and also the network we are in, the society we are in. So we also decided to break down this goal into four different commitments. The first one is that by 2030, we only want to sell circular products. The second is that by the same date, we only want to use renewable or recycled materials. And we will also want to develop new ways to meet our customers and offer them new way to acquire things, care for the products that they love, but also pass them on when they want to get rid of them. And last but not least, very conscious of the importance of shifting towards a circular economy, we want to take the lead of this change and partner up with others and also make sure that we enable the customers to be part of this change towards a more sustainable way of living.
Can you tell us a little bit about the pilot furniture hiring project that you're developing now in Sweden?
That pilot is connected to the area I mentioned before about the new ways to meet our customers, because we want to allow people to experience different way to acquire things, and leasing, subscribing, renting out stuff is very linked to this new opportunity. And the reasons why we are launching this pilot like others is that we want to start making things on a smaller scale in an agile way to really try and stress what we have been developing and what we have been identified as basis for our circular strategy. But we also believe that, you know, you're at a point that you need to make things and dare to also make mistakes, because that's the only way to really learn how things can work and work in the best possible way. So we hope that with these pilots, again, agile and small, we can learn very, very fast how can we set ourselves to be a truly circular business, yes, by 2030, but as soon as possible, so that we can meet our customer new needs for alternative way to approach and experience furniture, as also the other products we have.
How much are your customers, particularly your business customers, asking for this sort of approach?
I mean, what we always strive to do at IKEA is to meet our customers' needs. And in the last years, we, during our constant explorations and chats with our customers, we learned that our customers' needs are changing. People doesn't want to feel wasteful. So from one side, you see that people is well aware of the impact their choices have on the environment, and they don't want to be wasteful anymore. But at the same time, they still feel the need to vitality to change their minds and ideas, and therefore change how their homes look like. And we see in the circular economy an amazing opportunity to support them both the ways, because taking the responsibility of the products once the customers don't want to love them anymore, allow us to make sure that the product values is unleashed and these products can be loved by someone else. If before one product was loved and kept by only one customer, now with a circular supply chain, and in a broader sense, a circular value chain, we can take back products and make sure that they can flow back and loop as many times as possible, experiencing not only one loop that was and that is still the sale point, but also they can flow back and be refurbished or remanufactured.
And what evidence do you have for your retail customers that they also would like to develop this sort of approach?
What we believe is that exploring these new ways for customers to acquire, care for, and pass on things, we are supporting them to be part of the solution. People will embrace new ways to connect with the products that they love, either at home or in the office, and step by step, develop a new approach on the products and develop also a new, more sustainable way of living. So for example, those customers now are more reluctant to solutions based on subscription or renting or leasing models because they kind of feel hooked by these continuous interactions. We hope that can change their mind and see in these new business models a way for them to be more sustainable, because they will make sure that it would be easier for us to get back the products. And once we take them back, more easily we can secure that the highest possible value from the product is unleashed through the different loops of refurbishment, remanufacturing, and recycling.
Do you think that from a consumer perspective, circular models work better in the sort of more mass market end of the furniture sector? People buying IKEA furniture, they see it as it's not a lifetime purchase at any stage. So then this model of returning and reuse is one that's going to work well.
We think yes. I mean, of course, we will need to adapt these new offers to the different geographies and different customers. And we want to be still relevant for all the customers, actually many more of the customers. But we believe that in different ways, everyone is engaged and that will enjoy this new approach to things. Because though there are many differences, of course, being in a very privileged global position, everywhere we met with our customers and we asked them what they think about this, every time we have been said that they want to stop feeling wasteful. They want to get rid from a massive consumption habits rather than enjoy the value of the products, seek for the value from the products rather than the mass consumption. And we hope that with this new business model, we can really enable them in doing it.
But what is the timescale for rolling out circular models to retail customers?
As usual, we set the bar very high. So we said that by 2030, we want to become a truly circular business. But we are well aware that it's a huge challenge, both internally and externally. I mean, internally, we need to secure that all our business, all the entities in our constellation move together towards becoming a circular business. And externally, we also need the conditions to be there. And that's why we are also working with external partners to make sure that these external factors are in place. There's still a long journey ahead of us, but we are doing our best to learn as fast as possible how we can make these things and how we can make this change happen, partnering up with other external players and our customers as well.
What are the specific big practical challenges then that you face in shifting to circular models from traditional linear ones?
If we keep a split of internal and external factors and we start from the internal one, we are indeed quite big. Many people working in different entities, and we also work very closely with our suppliers. And for a circular business to happen, we need to move and transform at the same pace and all together. This change cannot be done if only one part of the organization is changing and transforming into a circular setup. That, of course, can give you an idea of the magnitude of the change, even because, again, we sit on a privileged position because we have control of all the value chain, from how we meet the customers to how we design the product, how we develop them, the choice of the materials. So the value chain that we control is pretty comprehensive. And we need to find new ways to work in this value chain, meaning new ways to offer solutions to our customers, new ways to develop circular products and set up our circular supply chain. That takes, of course, a lot of time and effort. So now we are kind of progressing slowly, but we are sure that once we become proficient with the new capabilities that are also required in this case, we'll keep and increase the pace of the change. Externally, there are many challenges. One of them is to agree on a definition of what's inside circular economy. We all agree that it's which are the key differences between a linear economy and a circular economy. But for example, on the definition of what we mean for refurbishment, there's not necessarily one agreement. And also many are still focusing on the recycle loops, while we push very much on the refurbishment and on the remanufacturing, because we believe that at those stages sits the highest value of the products. Then there are other capabilities that now are still missing and that are relevant for a circular business to fly, like, for example, and reliable and complete information flow about the products. Because what we miss now is that once our customers buy our products, we don't have control over those products anymore. So we are now trying to learn which systems can be developed so that for the customers that still prefer to have a one-shop experience, we can still track those products. And once the customers want to get rid of them, we can take back with us and still make sure that they can flow and be loved by someone else. But an information flow on the products is also relevant across companies and industries, because if we know what's inside one product, it's easier for us and for others to reuse that product regardless of who manufactured it. The business intelligence on the product and the tracking of the information related to them is very, very important. Last but not least, we, of course, need harmonized rules and regulation system across countries and industries so that we can really push for a circular economy to fly between companies, but also we can support the customers to embrace this change.
Do you think that customers are still quite a long way away from thinking in terms of leasing furniture, leasing things from the home? Do they still prefer to buy and then return?
There are different customers with different preferences. That's the thing. And we want to be relevant for all of them. There is still someone who believes that it's better to have one-stop shop shopping experience, but there are many that want to experience something different because they see the higher sustainability potential and also a way to satisfy these ownership-related feelings and needs. It's not that exists only one preference. We are actually enlarging the offer because we see many more preferences. But still, we believe and we hope that in the future, the most sustainable offers would be those prevailing, because meanwhile, people will have had the chance to change their mind and embrace new approaches.
What have been the conversations you've had with your suppliers? How much of a challenge has it been to bring them with you on your move towards more circular models?
But our suppliers are our partners for growth. They always been and they will always be. So they are key resources for us. We will not be able to become a circular business without them. So we are engaging them, explaining why we are doing this. And the reactions that we are having are very good, I have to say. And I'm very happy about that, because they see the needs that we identified as the reasons why we want to become a circular business. I mean, we want to decouple our growth from the natural resources, and they believe in the importance of this change. What is a business opportunity? It's also a huge responsibility that we have, and they want to be part of this.
This thinking forwards then, and in closing, what are the limits to this approach then? What are the limits to circular economy? And how far do you think customers will welcome an ongoing relationship with you then, rather than the one-off transaction that we talked about?
As long as we will keep on hearing and talking with our customers, we will always be prepared to face in advance the limits. For now, the limitations are more to set the precondition for this transformational journey, to develop new capabilities that are necessary to move from a linear to circular supply chain and business. In the future, we still don't know. But again, it's important that we stay relevant to our approach that is really customer-centric. First, hear our customer, what they say, what they need, the pain points that they have, and together with them and our suppliers, trying to develop in advance solutions that can prevent these limits to really become a constraint.
Seems to me that it's all about developing different sort of relationships with your customers.
Customers are always our starting point. On a daily basis, we really work with our vision in mind to make a better everyday life for the many people. And if you don't hear the many people, how can you make their life better? So that's always our starting point.
Well, it's all fascinating stuff. No doubt there'll be more innovation to come on circular economy models from IKEA and others. But for now, Elinoria Thierry from IKEA, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much to you.
As a preview to some of the issues we'll be covering in London next month at the Innovation Forum Business and Modern Slavery event, here is another chance to hear an interview my colleague Toby Webb had with Lola Baroness Young in London last October.
You've very kindly given up some of your time to come and talk to our audience here and engage in dialogue about modern slavery and human rights. We just had our opening session, which was under the Chatham House rule. But how would you describe the last hour or so in your own words, Lola? What do you think we've been discussing and what's your takeaway?
I would say there's an air of frustration about now. Okay, so we've had the Modern Slavery Act since 2015 and transparency in supply chains is a very important part of that. And we've been talking about it. You know, my colleagues on the panel, colleagues in the audience, I'm sure have also heard quite a lot about it. And I think we're now getting to the level where, okay, we've had this preliminary discussion. What is it? How can we do it? Why should we be doing it? But the thing is, how are we going to stop? How are we going to eliminate or at least work towards eliminating modern forms of slavery from supply chains? We haven't got the answers yet. We've got some solutions, but I think there's a general feeling, this might be my bias, my general feeling, maybe I should say, is that government needs to do more, businesses need to do more, investors could be a bit more active, and maybe some consumers could do a little bit too. But whatever it is, you know, we haven't got to a stage where we have the same kind of traction as environmental issues, particularly if you think about plastic, as somebody said, you know, the whole plastics thing, everybody's into their drinking bottles and not using plastic bottles and all the rest of it, and how you can upcycle all of that. We need that kind of momentum to develop very, very quickly in this area.
So given the work you do in the House of Lords, you know, raising awareness for this, what's the sort of average reaction from people who haven't heard of this? Because you'd have thought things like palm oil, we're all agreed we want it to be sustainable. Plastics, we're all agreed we want them to be sustainable. Nobody wants modern slavery.
Nobody wants modern slavery.
Surely it should be as easy, not that they're easy wins, but there should be the same level of interest.
Well, can I do a little bit of history here? And I think this is part of the problem, interestingly enough. So when people think of slavery, they think of the transatlantic slave trade, even though there have been different models of slavery since humans have learned how to enslave people, so for almost forever. And so that there was a feeling that there was a line drawn under the whole concept of slavery in the 19th century. If you come to, let's say, 2009, where I passed my first amendment in the House of Lords, which was to criminalise forced labour and domestic servitude. And at that stage, in 2009, people were saying to me, but isn't it already a criminal offence?
I'm astounded that it wasn't.
It wasn't. It wasn't at all. And the then Labour government were very resistant initially.
Why?
Well, because they claimed false imprisonment was a way of getting this. So there's civil torts around the area. Mm. There wasn't any criminal law around it. So people started to come to me. I met some victims. I met some people who worked with victims. And this was on a relatively small scale, because we were talking about in that domestic setting a lot of the time. And you thought, how can this be going on next door to me, maybe, or somebody else? So that at that stage, parliamentarians were saying, what's this about? Never heard of this. What's going on? I think it was Aidan from Anti-Slavery International said it's a historical anomaly, because enslavement was never formally or legally allowed on British soil, people didn't think to legislate against it.
I see. Okay.
So now we're trying to write that, but also looking at it in that global sense. So if you fast forward from 2009 to 2018, that's 9 years. many, many, many more people are much more aware of it. Okay, levels are still too low, but many, many people are much more aware of the kinds of things that can happen. So now that we know, we can't unknow that, and we've got to do something really decisive about it.
How would you like to see the Modern Slavery Act moving forward in terms of awareness and enforcement? And we've just had a session where we're kind of bemoaning government inactivity. At the moment, we don't have a Modern Slavery Commission. What are the chances of further activity in the coming years? And if the UK government is distracted by Brexit and by its sort of own ineptitude, shall we say, what are the other rays of light in terms of other governments that you think about? So UK first and then perhaps some other governments.
Yes, sure. So my feeling is it's part of my job to harass government. And so when I look at Section 54, we passed that legislation very quickly because an election was imminent and therefore we had to do it or abandon it. And so I think most people felt, well, as flawed as the Act is, it's better to have it than not. So we passed it. And I think at the time I tried to introduce an amendment straight away, which was to include public bodies in Section 54. Billions and billions of pounds worth of contracts are given out. At the moment, government departments give contracts out to companies who aren't even legally compliant with Section 54. There's a hell of a lot of work to be done there. So I think, yes, harassing government is really, really important. In terms of how we might move forward, especially thinking about how we can collaborate internationally, lots of us, particularly through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, I meant to mention that earlier, because they're doing a really good job of saying to all those Commonwealth countries, many of whom are, as it were, the suppliers of modern slaves and exploited labour, to say to them, look, this is happening in your backyard. It's also happening that this country X is exporting, as it were, these people to work in these conditions. You also have to do something in a legislative context. So we've been, through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, running workshops with different jurisdictions. My little fantasy, if you like, tells you how sad I am. A little fantasy is that in maybe 3 to 5 years, we would have a very big international conference which brings together, or symposium, which brings together businesses. It brings the good, the bad and the ugly in respect of this. It brings together different parliamentarians from various jurisdictions to say what they've been doing and how we can make it work better on a global scale. Because I think if we can produce what is effectively a legislative ring of fire, and there's no hiding place for either the businesses or the traffickers, then we might actually get somewhere. It feels like we've got quite a long way to go before we're ready to do that.
Yes.
And I'm not sure that there's even a precedent about it. But certainly I would point to issues around the environment. You know,
well, I mean, all sorts of treaties around chemicals, ozone, Montreal Protocol.
You know, there sexual is violence and conflict, all of those kinds of
areas. There's serious precedent here. I don't see why it can't be done.
No, but in this subject, it's not been done, I guess. And that is a challenge, particularly as we did have that discussion this morning about human rights or modern slavery. I mean, how do we frame the question even?
Yes.
And I think that needs to be discussed. We need to be quite open about that. So, for example, Caribbean countries don't want to talk to you about modern slavery because they're still reeling from the impact of the transatlantic slave trade and looking for reparations. So you have to use a different kind of language and a different kind of way in to getting them to think about what they've got to deal with.
Yeah.
With the Indian subcontinent, that term slavery doesn't have any kind of purchase at all.
Yep.
So people talk much more about abusive labour, trafficking, etc. In some of the sub-Saharan African countries, there's a fear that it's almost that the West is trying to stop us developing economically by coming down hard on our practices like traditional use of children and so on and so forth. So we have to be very sophisticated and nuanced in the way we address these issues and the way they manifest themselves. The UN recognises child marriage as a form of enslavement, which essentially it is. So how do you change those, what people see as traditional practices that have led to that? You know, we've got a huge job on our hands.
Well, we'd be happy to work with you on creating such a conference.
Fantastic.
It's what we do. I mean, we're more business orientated, but, we need to broaden in, particularly in this subject. Yeah. One final question for you. The B word, Brexit.
Oh, gosh.
I was listening to Farming Today the other day on Radio 4, and they were talking about 2,500 trial visas being issued for agricultural workers coming in from outside the EU. And I envisioned all these Brexiteers who hated all these European migrants suddenly falling in love with these other migrants who come in, and they didn't seem likely to happen to me. Is Brexit going to be a good thing or a bad thing for Modern Slavery? Because I can see some big scandals happening.
Oh, it could be a disaster. And let me be clear, I'm not in favour of Brexit, but this is where we are. Or where are we? I don't know. Anyway,
we're not quite sure where we are.
It's interesting, just coming back from Brussels, because it's flooded with British people at the moment, all trying to work out where we are. But I think there are two or more threats around Brexit. One is what you've just mentioned, is if you get these people in, are we going to be making sure that they're paid properly, et cetera, et cetera, and good working conditions? We know that agriculture, for example, is a really high risk in terms of modern slavery, and we've seen cases have come to court around that sector. So again, we come back to the question of how is it going to be policed and monitored that people are being treated correctly. Mm-hmm. The other fear that is very real and present is that what gains we have made may be destroyed by the desire and compulsion to create trade deals with countries that actually will say, we're not very interested in human rights, actually, but we'll do a trade deal with you if you cut that bit out about modern slavery and human rights.
Yeah.
So we're in danger, I think, of losing what gains we have made. The trouble is that there's so many different places where we need to focus energy, and there's not enough of us to go around.
Yes.
So any solutions you've got to that innovative forum? Tell us.
People's vote on Brexit.
Yeah.
Let's just do that and stop this silly nonsense. That'll give us a bit more resources to focus on what's really important.
Yeah.
That's all I've got.
We'll talk about that forever.
We'll do another two hours on Brexit. So we'll draw this to a close. Lola, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Toby.
And for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
There will be a much more similar discussion in London when we focus on business and modern slavery at the offices of Freshfields on 2nd and 3rd of April in a few weeks' time. Don't forget to book your place this week to save £100. And do sign up for next week's Food Sector Innovation Webinar on Thursday, 14th of March. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.